Welcome to today's deep dive. I'm your host, and I want you to try something for just a second.
And I'm your resident expert, ready to jump right in. What are we trying?
Okay, so look at your hand, or just look at the desk in front of you, or your phone. Your brain tells you that you are looking at a thing.
Right.
It's solid, it's static, it's just sitting there until something comes along and pushes it. We tend to think the universe is basically a collection of these nouns. Just isolated objects floating around in space.
Yeah, that's the classic billiard ball model of reality. And honestly, it feels intuitively right to us. I mean, we see things, we name things, they bump into each other.
It does feel right. But today, we're going to look at why that intuition might be completely wrong. We're exploring the work of Alfred North Whitehead, who was a thinker who argued that the universe actually isn't made of stuff at all. He argued that reality is made of events. So it's not a noun, it's a verb.
Right. And this is what's known as process philosophy. To guide us through this today, we have an incredible lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes. He does a really phenomenal job of unpacking Whitehead. It's a dense topic, I won't lie, but the mission for our deep dive today is to understand how Whitehead tried to build this single unified picture of the world that somehow fits quantum physics, romantic poetry, and even theology all into one framework.
Which, sounds like an impossible mix. I mean, usually you keep your physics and your poetry in totally separate rooms.
Definitely.
But Whitehead is this fascinating figure to attempt this because he actually had a foot firmly in both worlds. He wasn't just some mystic musing out in a garden. He was a really hard-nosed mathematician first.
No, an absolute heavyweight. Mm-hmm. He spent the first part of his career at Cambridge. He actually co-authored the Principia Mathematica with Bertrand Russell. And that book is, well, it's arguably one of the most rigorous logical attempts to ground mathematics ever written in human history. So this is a man who deals in hard, rigorous mathematical structure.
Right. And then at age 63, which is when most academics are, you know, just coasting to retirement or tending to their gardens, he packs up, moves across the ocean to Harvard, and totally pivots to metaphysics.
It's such a radical second act. He basically looked at the scientific materialism of the day. That's the idea that the world is just this dead mechanical machine. And he realized it just didn't match the new data coming out of physics. He wanted to build a naturalistic way to explain why the world actually feels alive and connected and creative.
So let's get into that shift. Because he didn't just wake up one morning and decide, hey, rocks are alive. He was building on a very specific philosophical lineage.
Yeah.
Holmes mentions the ghost of Hegel kind of looming over all of this.
Yeah, you really can't escape Hegel in the 19th century. Hegel and the other idealists had this view of evolutionary idealism. They basically believed the world was a spirit or a mind that was constantly unfolding and evolving over time. It wasn't static at all. It was a process. And Whitehead looked at that and said, okay, the process part is correct. Reality is evolutionary, it's moving.
But he rejected the idealism part.
Right, exactly.
Because idealism implies it's all just mental, that the physical world is kind of an illusion or just secondary to the mind. And Whitehead seemed to really want to keep the rocks and the trees real.
Precisely. He wanted a naturalistic metaphysics. He didn't want to just throw up his hands and say the world is a dream. But, and here's the total curveball, to understand the physical world, he didn't just look at his math equations. He looked at William Wordsworth.
The poet.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit, when I saw that in the notes for this deep dive, I had to do a double take. You have the author of the Principia Mathematica reading poems about daffodils to understand the fundamental structure of the universe.
It sounds totally absurd until you see what he was actually looking for. Whitehead's daughter reportedly said he read Wordsworth like it was the Bible. You see, Wordsworth and the Romantics absolutely hated the Enlightenment view of science. They looked at a machine universe, you know, just gears, pulleys, dead matter, and they said this leaves something massive out.
Right, because when you look at nature, you don't just see a mechanism, you see value.
Exactly, you see something organic and just brooding with life.
So Whitehead is trying to rescue that feeling of value. He thinks the poets are actually picking up on a piece of raw data, which is the feeling of the world.
Yeah.
That the scientists were just completely ignoring because it didn't fit neatly into their test tubes.
He literally thought the poets were being better empiricists than the scientists. They were reporting the world as it is actually felt, as this interconnected living web, whereas the scientists were just describing a mathematical abstraction.
But obviously, he couldn't just rely on poetry. He needed the hard science to back it up. And this is where the timing of Whitehead's life is just so crucial. He's working right as the floor is dropping out from under Newtonian physics.
That's the key context here. If he had lived 50 years earlier, he might have been stuck. But he's watching the birth of modern physics firsthand. he sees electromagnetic field theory emerge. And suddenly, physical bodies aren't just solid lumps of matter anymore. They are centers of force fields that extend indefinitely out into space.
Right, and then quantum mechanics hits.
Yeah.
And suddenly the atom, which literally means the uncuttable building block, it just dissolves into energy and probability.
And then the final nail in the coffin is Einstein and relativity. Space and time, which Newton thought were just these empty containers that you put stuff inside of, they turn out to be relative. They're woven together into space-time. There's actually that famous anecdote where a professor remarked that only two people effectively understood relativity, Einstein and Whitehead.
Wow. I mean, whether that's perfectly true or not, the implication of it is huge.
Yeah.
Whitehead realized that the scientific realists, the people who pounded the table and said, I only believe in solid matter, were actually believing in a total fantasy. They were believing in stuff that physics had just proven didn't even exist.
Science itself had become almost mystical in a sense. It showed that the fundamental reality is activity, flux, and relationship. Energy is activity. So the universe isn't a collection of things at all. It's a collection of events.
And this leads us to one of Whitehead's most famous contributions, his critique of how we think about the world. He started pointing out these logical traps we fall into when we try to describe this really fluid, energetic world using our static, noun-based language. The big one is the fallacy of misplaced concreteness.
Yes, and this is a concept everyone should have in their mental toolkit. The fallacy of misplaced concreteness is basically when you mistake the map for the territory. Science builds models. It uses abstract concepts like a frictionless surface or a perfect point in space. And those are incredibly useful abstractions for doing math. The error happens when we forget they are abstractions and we start treating them as the concrete reality itself.
It's like looking at a menu in a restaurant and trying to eat the menu. The menu describes the food, gives you the structure of the meal, but it isn't the food itself.
That's a fantastic way to put it. And Whitehead thought we were doing exactly that with matter. We created the abstract idea of dead matter to make the math easier for ourselves, and then we literally fooled ourselves into thinking the universe was actually made of dead matter.
And related to that is his fallacy of simple location. I found this one really bends your brain if you sit with it for a minute. It completely challenges the idea that things have strict boundaries.
It challenges our absolute deepest assumption. The assumption that you can point and say, this cup is right here, and that statement is true regardless of what else is happening in the universe or in time.
Right. But in a relativistic universe, here actually depends on when, and it heavily depends on the observer.
Because everything is bleeding into everything else. An electron doesn't have a simple location. It has a field of influence that theoretically stretches across the entire universe. So you simply can't isolate a piece of reality and say, this is it, right here. All alone. Nothing is alone. For Whitehead, to be is to be related.
Okay, so we have a universe of flowing events. It's interconnected. It's energetic. But if everything is just flux and energy, why isn't it just total chaos? Why do we have tulips and solar systems and logic? This brings us to the third pillar of his thought, which is surprisingly theological. It goes back to the church fathers of Alexandria.
Yeah, we've gone all the way from quantum physics to ancient theology. Whitehead was digging back into antiquity for the concept of the logos.
The word. The rational order of things.
Exactly. He needed to explain the source of order in this flux. Why does the universe seem to continually strive toward complexity and beauty? He argues that the ultimate reality, the thing at the very bottom of the metaphysical pile, is creativity.
Wait, not God?
No, God is actually secondary to creativity in his system. Creativity is the ultimate foundational principle. He defines it as the process of the emergence of novelty. The universe is essentially a machine for making new things. That is just what it does.
So what is God's job then? If creativity is the engine driving everything, is God just sitting in the passenger seat?
In process philosophy, God is the orderer of this creativity. God holds the possibilities. Think of it this way. Creativity is the engine, but God provides the map or the sheet music. God presents the universe with the possibilities of order and beauty and persuades the universe to move in that direction.
Persuades is a really specific word choice there. He doesn't say commands.
And that's the crucial distinction Whitehead makes. This isn't a God who snaps his fingers and creates ex nihilo, meaning out of nothing. This is a God who works with the creative process that already exists, continually offering the best possible options. The universe then decides how to respond to those options. It's a partnership.
That actually moves us nicely into how all of this applies to us. Because if the universe is this dynamic flow of events and persuasion, our daily experience of it must be very different than what we typically assume. We usually think of perception like a camera just taking a photo of the world.
That is the standard view, and Holmes traces that back to John Locke. Locke basically said, I open my eyes, I see a shape and a color, which he called an idea, and then my brain works backward to infer, oh, there must be a physical cup over there causing that image.
It's a very intellectual, disconnected way of looking at it. It assumes we are basically spectators sitting in a dark theater, just watching images play on a screen inside our heads.
And Whitehead hates that view. He calls it the fallacy of the primacy of presentational immediacy. He argues that if Locke were right, we'd never actually know for sure that the outside world exists. We'd just be trapped forever in that cinema of images in our heads. Whitehead says our connection to the world is much more visceral than that. He breaks human perception down into three distinct modes, and the order of them really matters.
Okay, the first one is causal efficacy. This seems to be the most primal, raw mode of experiencing the world.
It is. It's the one we usually ignore in philosophy, but it's the most real. Holmes uses the brilliant example of getting punched in the face. If someone hauls off and socks you on the jaw, in that exact split second of physical impact, you have a clear visual image of a fist. Do you sit back and ponder, I am perceiving a sensation of pressure on my cheek?
No, absolutely not. You reel back. You feel the violence of the impact before you even know what it is. You literally feel the cause entering your body.
That is causal efficacy. It's the direct feeling of the cause pushing into you. The universe impacts you physically and emotionally before you ever turn it into a clear, distinct picture. We feel the heavy presence of the past pushing right into our present moment.
Then comes a second mode, which is presentational immediacy.
Right. This is the clear picture, the symbol. You hear a loud sound, which is the causal efficacy, and your brain instantly flashes a picture in your mind, phone ringing. That clear mental image is presentational immediacy. This is the part John Locke focused on entirely, just the sharp image.
And then the third mode is symbolic reference. This is linking the first two together. But Whitehead warns us that this is exactly where we screw things up.
Right, because the feeling is always true. Something really did make a sound and impact your eardrum. But the symbol your brain provides can be wrong. You might think phone ringing, but it's actually your alarm clock. The error isn't in the raw sensation of the world. It's entirely in your interpretation of it.
I think this is why Whitehead's philosophy feels so grounded to me, despite being so abstract on paper. He's validating that deep gut feeling we all have, that we are actually in the world, not just looking at it through a window. We are absorbing the causal impact of the universe every single second of our lives.
We are fully part of the flow. And this structure, absorbing the past and reacting to it, it isn't just for humans. Whitehead applies this to absolutely everything. He calls it the anatomy of an event. And Holmes uses the story of his own tulips to illustrate this perfectly.
This really brings it down to earth. Let's break down the life of a tulip using process philosophy. There are three stages to any event in the universe.
First, you have the objective data. This is simply the past. For the tulip, the objective data is the bulb itself, the soil chemistry, the fact that it rained heavily last week. It's everything that has happened up until this exact microsecond. That is the given reality pushing into the present.
Okay, so the past is the fuel. Then comes the cloud of eternal objects.
Which is just a very fancy Whitehead term for possibilities. Given that specific objective data, what could happen next? The tulip could bloom early in a massive blaze of red color. That is a potential reality that exists in the universe. Or if the weather turns bad, it could freeze and die. These possibilities are real abstract potentials just hovering over the event, waiting.
And finally, you have the decision.
The cutoff point. The word decision literally comes from a Latin root meaning to cut off. To make something real, you have to kill off all the other possibilities. In Holmes's example, a sudden frost hits. The temperature drops to 10 degrees. The universe, meaning the environment and the tulip together, makes a decision. The possibility of blooming is cut off forever. The possibility of freezing is actualized.
And the event is over. The tulip dies.
But notice the fundamental structure of what just happened. It's not a mechanical dead gear turning. It is a creative selection. The universe took the past, weighed the possibilities, and settled on a specific, concrete future. Whitehead thinks this exact cycle happens at every single level of reality, from a tiny electron deciding which energy state to jump to, all the way up to you deciding what words to say next.
It really reframes what time actually is. Time isn't just a clock ticking away in the background of an empty room. Time is this perpetual process of turning possibility into fact through decision.
That's the beauty of his entire system. You are a focal point where the universe is literally making up its mind. You aren't an isolated spectator at all. You are taking in the entire history of the universe as your objective data, and you are constantly facing a cloud of eternal objects. And in every single moment, you are making a decision that adds a brand new brick to the reality of the future.
It makes the concept of free will feel so much more tangible. It's not some magic spark outside of physics. It's the fundamental mechanic of how reality advances. We're constantly resolving possibilities.
It gives an incredible dignity to the present moment. It means what you do is reality in the making.
That is a heavy but deeply empowering place to land. We've covered a lot of ground here, from the death of the billiard ball universe to the anatomy of a tulip freezing in a garden.
And the main takeaway is really that profound shift from substance to process. The world isn't a collection of dead things. It's a creative advance into novelty.
I want to leave you with a thought to carry into the rest of your day. Based on those eternal objects we just talked about. Right now, as you're listening to this, you are surrounded by invisible possibilities. There is a version of the next 5 minutes where you turn off this audio and call an old friend. There's a version where you just sit in silence. There's a version where you finally start that new project. These are all eternal objects hovering around you right now. In a few seconds, you will make a decision. You will pull one of those possibilities down into reality and make it a hard fact of the universe, and you will send all the others back into the void, maybe forever. So the question is, which possibility are you going to actualize next? Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll see you next time.